One of the major frustrations with COVID-19 is that there's no pill to make it go away and no vaccine to keep from getting it. But for so many other medical afflictions, we have drugs. Oh, do we have drugs? And one of the stories of our time is the explosion of generic drugs, cheaper versions of prescription drugs that are supposed to work as well as the originals, but are much more affordable. Cross that with another of the stories of our time, globalization, and we've got generic drugs coming at us from all over the world. Our guest this hour spent a decade researching generic drugs. Catherine Eben wrote Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. Catherine is an investigative journalist who has focused largely on pharmaceuticals, gun trafficking, and coercive CIA investigations. Her first book from 2005 is Dangerous Doses, Bottle of Lies, which came out last year, is a New York Times bestseller. Catherine Eben, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's start with the recent, because you wrote that article in Time magazine dated March 26th, which seems like it's had a couple of different moves since that time. It starts with hydroxychloroquine, which of course President Trump has been boosting as a potential remedy for COVID-19, but this created some supply issues with India, evidently.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, because of his claims from the podium, there has been a sort of instant worldwide shortage of that drug. There are also shortages of a number of other drugs. We are largely dependent on India and China for a whole range of medicines. And, you know, now hydroxychloroquine, there's no credible evidence yet that it... can treat COVID-19, but that drug is in short supply, and the Indian government had, until just the other day, put an export ban on essential drugs, that one included.
Well, and I noticed that India banned the export. Apparently there was a threat from President Trump, and then just within the last day, the ban was lifted?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that has been reported, so... presumably, that will reopen supply for that drug. But again, there is no evidence that it cures anything other than, you know, intended uses for malaria, and it also people who suffer from arthritis and other afflictions do use it.
Now, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, had previously restricted the company that would be providing hydroxychloroquine, the Indian company.
Yes, that's right.
Huh.
That's right.
But what? So because it has hydroxychloroquine, its safety record is suddenly considered okay?
Right. So, I mean, you know, this is what we are now confronting, which is that the FDA, in its scramble to try to make certain drugs available, is overlooking the safety record of Indian companies that it knows to have been, faking quality data. So, you know, now... for an unproven drug, we are lifting restrictions on plants that just a month ago weren't safe enough to make any drug.
Which really gets us into the broader issue then of the fact that, you know, we get used to hearing about things like we get surgical masks from China and we get other protective equipment from China and other countries in Asia, but we depend on China, India, and other countries around the world for so many different parts of our health system.
You know, this pandemic has really highlighted what has been evident to a number of experts for years, which is that we are dangerously dependent on India and China for our medicine. I testified at a commission in August where a Pentagon official said that this was a national security risk, and he's not wrong. You know, I mean, to not make your own essential medicines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we have this global supply chain where, you know, a lot of active ingredients are made in northern Italy. Look at what's been going on in Italy. A lot of active ingredient for all our drugs are made in China. We are reliant on India for finished doses of generics. We get 40% of our generic drugs from India. So set aside even the question of quality, and our dependence is a very, very risky thing.
And when you're thinking about the quality part of this, it becomes clear, not very far into your book, Bottle of Lies, that, that regulatory capture, particularly overseas, sounds more like a feature than a bug.
You know, so here's the problem. If we are, as FDA is expected to safeguard the quality of drugs in overseas plants, they're the sheriffs, and these plants don't fear their own regulators, right? There is a very cozy relationship between the Indian plants and its own regulators. You know, the only way that is guaranteed to get these manufacturing plants to behave and follow regulations is if they fear the consequences of not doing so, right? Mm-hmm. But if you have a double header of them not fearing the consequences and them being able to profit off of not following the regulations, which is one of the things my book uncovered, you really have a recipe for disaster.
There's and it's interesting too, because as you point out, unlike in this country where they can show up unannounced, they have to pretty much make appointments with the overseas plants.
You know, they don't actually have to. That is a choice that the FDA has made, in part because it's just logistically simpler to do so. So, you know, you have this remarkable, you know, in the U.S., FDA shows up unannounced. They don't say how long they're going to stay. They just arrive and do an inspection. And plants are fearful of their arrival, and they fear the consequences of what the FDA might find. But overseas, because logistics are complicated, it's hard to get visas, the FDA has sort of adopted this system where they give these plants 2 months of advance notice, and the FDA inspectors become their invited guests.
Oh boy, you can just imagine all the things that are possible there, and we get into that in the book. The book is called Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. It's the work of Catherine Eben, who's our guest. It's been on the bestseller list on the New York Times since it came out last year. We'll come back and talk more with Catherine. You are welcome to join us with your phone calls and emails. We return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. And so you give a good history of generic drugs in this country. And in fact, you point out our own Senator Ron Wyden, when he was still in the House more than 30 years ago, called the generic drug industry a swamp that must be drained. Heard words like that before. So give us an overview here of like when generic drugs first began to be a thing and when they began to move offshore.
Right. So, you know, the U.S. used to be one of the biggest manufacturers of antibiotics, but really, at the turn of the century, you know, by, say, 2000-2001, China had become a dominant manufacturer of antibiotics. And it was a sort of globalization trend that continued with other drugs, the point where, by 2004, the last penicillin plant in the U.S. closed. And by then, the FDA had more plants to inspect overseas than it did within U.S. borders. So, you know, it was a trend that began and accelerated as Western companies realized that they could manufacture drugs much more cheaply in India or China, and they could also develop some distance and breathing room from U.S. regulators, which I think is part of the problem. At the same time, what we saw is Indian companies and Chinese companies capitalizing on a huge need for low-cost medicine in the U.S. And those overseas manufacturers began to get approvals from the FDA to sell their drugs inside of the U.S. And basically, you know, fast forward to where we are today, 90% of our drug supply is generic. The majority of those drugs are made overseas. 40% of those drugs come from India. 80% of the active ingredient in all our drugs, brand or generic, come from abroad. So, you know, the odds are if you go to a pharmacy and fill a prescription, you're probably getting a drug that was made in India or China.
Which, and here's where you give an example, and I think cheese is actually a pretty good one. I mean, you decide to buy cheddar or Velveeta, but when you do so, you know the difference. When you
right.
get the name brand versus a generic drug, you really don't know what's in that.
Right. I mean, most people don't even look at the manufacturer name. Like, so you're on a maintenance drug, you go every month to the pharmacy. You don't look to see if the manufacturer has changed. Most people, if they're getting a generic, don't know who the manufacturer is that is making their drug. Now, why don't people look? I think it's because the FDA has reassured us that all these drugs are interchangeable, that the brand is interchangeable with the generic. You could switch between generics. But, you know, what my investigation indicates is that there are very different quality issues behind each one of these drugs. And, you know, the book documents frightening lapses in quality in these far-flung plants that we all depend on.
Catherine, what does law or regulation specify? Does the generic drug need to be 70% as effective, 90% as effective, as effective?
It essentially needs to be as effective. So the FDA has created a bioequivalence standard, where the generic has to fall within an allotted range of absorption into the blood. So it has to essentially have the same clinical therapeutic efficacy as the brand name drug. So that's the standard. There are people that have argued that the standard is too loose, and that may well be the case for time-release drugs, for example. But the issue that I wanted to look into is, you know, are the companies that are 7,000 miles away actually following the standards on paper? And what I discovered is that those companies are often falsifying their data to make it appear that their drugs are meeting those standards when they are not.
Catherine Eben is an investigative journalist and the author of Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. We should point out your work started 10 years before the publication of the book with generic drugs that had some problems.
That's right. So it was 2008, and I got a tip from a radio show host, a guy named Joe Graydon, who does a show called The People's Pharmacy on NPR. And he called me and he said he was being flooded with complaints from patients who were saying that their generics were causing adverse, unwelcome side effects. So I began to dig, and, you know, the more I reported, I was contacted by some whistleblowers, and I began to realize that if I actually wanted to understand, you know, really what the issue was with these drugs, that I had to look where they were being made, which was, you know, on a different continent.
Mm-hmm. You describe Bottle of Lies as a corporate crime story. We'll get into who the criminals are, but in the year since publication, has anybody paid any penalties?
Well, you know, I would say that the book has really exposed this issue. And the falsifications taking place in these plants, these remote plants. Congress has held hearings, so there has been, you know, federal investigations of this issue. But, you know, it's a tough season for making headway in Washington. You know, and now I would say with coronavirus, what this has really highlighted is the dangers of our dependence on this overseas drug supply.
Well, and you get to some real specifics in here, too, because take us along with an FDA inspection in India, which, obviously, as we mentioned, because of visas and all that sort of thing, it mm-hmm. was had to be announced in advance. Mm-hmm. So it seems like they put on a dog and pony show for the FDA person, and if they just watched that, they could easily miss something. But the person you describe here saw somebody coming down the hall with a bag of what?
Well, that's right. So the book opens with this an actual chase scene inside of a manufacturing plant. There's a young investigator named Peter Baker. he arrived at an Indian drug plant that makes sterile injectable drugs, like cardiac drugs, insulin, and, you know, these are very controlled environments where employees are not supposed to move quickly. Everything is very closely monitored, but he saw something strange, which was an employee holding a garbage bag and walking quickly as though trying to exit the plant. And he ordered the man to stop, and the man ran. And inside the garbage, he managed to retrieve the garbage bag. There were torn batch records. And those records showed that there were vials of insulin that had metallic particles in them, and the plant had knowingly released the insulin vials for sale and had falsified the official records to make it look like these vials passed inspection. You know, and that is the kind of really life-threatening falsification that is occurring at some of these plants.
And did you get a sense for this stuff happening often, or this was the outlier, or is it just sort of a general sweeping under the rug, throwing out the back door, changing the records a little bit kind of thing?
My investigation really shows that this kind of fraud is endemic throughout the industry. So, for example, Peter Baker, the inspector, he went to 86 plants in India and China over a four-year period. He found evidence of fraud in four-fifths of those plants.
Wow.
I mean, that really tells you this is how the industry works. So why does it work that way? Well, I mean, if you know, they are selling a product, I mean, people are willing to pay more for a latte than they are for a life-saving drug. Right? I mean, that's the whole goal of the generics, is to come in at the lowest price. So then the question is, well, how do the companies profit? And if they're following the regulations set out by the FDA, which are good manufacturing standards, that comes with a certain cost, right? You have to follow elaborate procedures. You have to investigate any errors. You have to destroy batches that don't meet quality standards. But what if you don't do that and make it look like you are doing that? Then you're going to cut your manufacturing costs and come in at a big profit.
And so if you think, well, you know, it's 89% as good. You know, we have to hit to 90. But yeah, I can see where there'd be the pressure in the factory to make it look good enough.
Right, right.
Catherine Eben is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. It took her 10 years of lots of flights all over the world to pull in the information for this very thorough book. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Since you were just talking about cutting costs, I mean, the obvious question for consumers is, are drug prices based on any real evaluation of costs?
That is the problem. No, they aren't, actually. I mean, they're largely based on what the market will bear. So the issue is that the generic world has what I call a deal sweetener, which is, for the first generic that can get FDA approval and come on the market, they get a period of exclusivity.
That's first to file? Is that what that status is?
That's first to file. Mm-hmm. And they can price their drug higher for that six-month period. So that first to file can be worth a fortune. For example, the Indian drug company Rambaxi had a first to file on generic Lipitor and made $600 million within 6 months.
Wow.
But once other generic drug companies come in and then you've got competition, the price plunges. So a lot of these companies are vying to be first onto the market. How do you get to be first? Well, instead of going through the laborious effort of testing a drug and making sure it works, what if you fake your data, get a first to file, and then sort of figure out how to make it on the fly? And that is one of the things that was driving fraud inside of the generic drug industry, is the drive to be first.
So, okay, this is where it's good to drill down into process here. Now, when a company that hasn't made a drug before, they're about to make a generic, are they working off of the patent holder's recipe, or have they just done a chemical analysis and tried to figure out how to replicate that? I mean, how close can they get with their process to the original process that created this drug that obviously made billions for somebody else?
Right. Well, that actually is a huge question. You know, so a lot of people think, well, it's this peaceful transfer of intellectual property. And actually, it's really a battle every step of the way. So the brand name companies try to protect their products by sort of encasing them in all these different patents, right? So they're saying the drug is under patent, the time-release formula is under patent. And what the generic companies do is they try to procure samples, break them down in a laboratory, and reverse engineer them. So how do you, they're trying to figure out how to kind of reinvent a drug using a different process, right? So maybe instead of a 10-step chemical process, they figure out a 5-step chemical process, and then they're able to challenge the patent in court, and they succeed in launching it. Nobody's given them the recipe, but they have to give data to the FDA saying, see, our drug is equivalent. So then, remarkably, the FDA reviews that data, but it doesn't routinely test the drug.
You describe FDA as the gold standard among regulators. Has that gold gotten a little dingy over the years?
Well, what really shocked me in doing my reporting is that it's probably true that the FDA is the gold standard, but what did I find inside of the FDA? The book is built on thousands of internal FDA documents that I managed to obtain. And really what these show is a kind of honor system in that, in the way that it's inspecting these companies. You know, it's reviewing company data. It's not testing drugs. It's pre-announcing its inspections overseas, right? It's not showing up unannounced. It, you know, there is a problem with its own investigators going into plants and finding horrible conditions and recommending very strict sanctions. And then the bureaucrats back at FDA headquarters downgrade those recommendations and they let plants off. And part of what that is aimed to do is to keep this supply of low-cost drugs going, but, you know, at what cost to the consumer? And that was really one of the things I wanted to figure out. You know, do these low-cost drugs come with essentially a hidden cost?
Oh, sure, an externalized cost. Yeah, so they cost you less at the counter, but what else are you paying for, or what are we paying for as a society otherwise?
Right.
Let's move beyond regulation and talk about the actual companies, because you do compare the likes of Bristol-Myers Squibb, you know, the old hands, to the newer ones. Like you just mentioned Ranbaxy, which is now transmogrified into something else. How different do you find the corporate governance and management between the old hands and the newer arrivals?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I think there is a difference when companies sort of form in a highly regulated environment. They develop a culture in which they are used to being scrutinized and they're used to very high standards. That is not to say that there isn't copious, you know, fraudulent schemes inside of Western brand name companies, because there are, and I've written about some of them. But in terms of what goes on in the lab, you know, in terms of the scientific standards, you know, what I was seeing is really extraordinary examples of fraud. So, for example, the Indian drug company Ranbaxy was India's largest company. It was a household name in India. They were literally taking, they were smuggling in brand name drug samples in suitcases that employees were ferrying from all over the world. They'd bring them into the company's labs in India. They'd run data off of the brand name samples and present it to regulators like, see how great our data is? our drugs are almost identical. They'd get approvals, and then they'd try to figure out how to actually make the drugs.
Oh, boy. And Dinesh Thakur at Ranbaxy, is he the one who blew the whistle on them?
Yeah, so he is the main character in Bottle of Lies, which really tells his story of his journey as a whistleblower. So, you know, he was asked by his boss at Ranbaxy, became suspicious of the company's data, and asked him to basically examine the company's filings and see whether the data was real or fake. And he uncovered that over 200 drug products in more than 40 countries had been filed with fake data.
Well, much more to come from Catherine Eban, who's the author of Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. We'll come back and talk more about how the generic drug situation relates to the current operations going on during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. My head is still vibrating from that's a significant revelation that companies that grew up in strict regulatory environments tend to be compliant. But the companies that grew up after that time and were, you know, in a more deregulated kind of situation seem to play it a little faster and looser.
You know, it's really, I think, related to how fearful they are of being caught. So if you have a company in an environment where you know, one of the things that a lot of my sources talked about in was Indian corporate culture, and there is a word called jugaad, which is basically the art of the shortcut, and that is looked on pretty favorably in a lot of Indian companies. Is that are you able to get to the desired outcome by the shortest means possible? So it's a way of steering around the obstacles, you know, and regulations are looked at as obstacles to be evaded. And that is what it was, you know, definitely uncovered at some of these plants.
Wow. So when Ranbaxy ended up paying, what, $500 million in fines for falsifying their records?
Right. So once Dinesh Thakur, who became a whistleblower, once his findings were put forward to the board of directors of Ranbaxy, the question they had was, how can we destroy these records of these findings and destroy the computer on which it was created? Then they forced him out of the company. So he ended up, you know, he became a whistleblower. He just couldn't stand the idea that these dangerous drugs were going to people all over the world, including in the U.S., including in Africa. So he became a whistleblower, and his documentation and his claims sparked an 8-year investigation in the U.S. in which Ranbaxy was finally forced to plead guilty to 7 felonies related to faking data. And today the company doesn't really exist anymore. But, you know, we know that there are many other companies that have been caught doing similar things, and they are still in operation.
Has Ranbaxy, since it was sold to Sun Pharma, has Sun Pharma managed to stay off the regulator S list?
No, actually they haven't. I mean, they've had a lot of sort of tangles with regulators, and a number of the Ranbaxy plants that they absorbed have never been able to operate anymore.
Huh. All right. So now I noticed when I looked at the Ranbaxy fine that I checked it out versus some other fines paid. I noticed that some drug makers have paid fines into the billions of dollars. Those seem to be more about off-label recommendations and
right.
Marketing, not so much about the contents. But is Ranbaxy's the biggest settlement based on the actual contents of the drugs?
Well, the way I would say it is this, which it is, first of all, it's the largest settlement ever made with a generic drug maker. But you're right to say that, you know, a lot of the sanctions against brand name companies have been for sales and marketing abuses. And we've seen that a lot, for example, in the opioid crisis. But really, you know, the fraud inside of these generic drug companies is related to quality, that they're actually fabricating or altering quality data in order to get approval to market their drugs. And what that means for a consumer is that the drug that you are taking to cure or treat some condition may not actually be bioequivalent. It may, you know, it the drugs that have reached U.S. consumers, generic drugs, have contained glass particles, metallic fragments, the impurity spikes, or are not bioequivalent. You know, these drugs are reaching U.S. consumers.
And we have a question from one of them right now. Boris and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Catherine Eben, the author of Bottle of Lies.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Do you have any evidence of actual harm that's come to patients, for instance, with these drugs that have impurities in them?
Yeah, actually, I do, unfortunately, which is, so for example, millions of Americans ended up getting generic blood pressure medicine, Valsartan and Losartan, which contained carcinogenic impurity spikes. And a lot of that active ingredient in those drugs came from India and China. And really tragically, this was a case where an FDA investigator was in a plant in China and said, hey, they don't appear to be investigating impurity spikes in their own drugs, which is required under regulations, and recommended a very strict sanction against the plant, and the FDA downgraded it. 1 year later, that plant was in the middle of a worldwide quality recall of its drugs.
Oh, wow. Thanks for the question there, Boris. It's a good one. And so, you know, I focused primarily on India so far, but you got lots of Chinese issues, too. Mm-hmm. And we have the whole issue with bad heparin getting to market in the United States. What happened there?
You know, the heparin, to me, the heparin crisis really underscores a fundamental problem. So this was a case in which there was what has sometimes been described as economic adulteration of the drug. They were swapping out one somewhere in the Chinese supply chain. Someone was swapping out one ingredient for another that was difficult to detect in order to increase the yield of the drug.
It's like a filler?
It was essentially. I mean, they were using an active ingredient that was not the right one. It was a sort of substitute that was hard to pick up on a lab test. And that led to the deaths of at least 80 Americans. And no one has ever been held responsible for that directly because we really didn't have cooperation from the Chinese authorities. So that's an instance where you can see the dangers of sourcing life-saving drugs from overseas where you don't have jurisdiction. There's no U.S. attorney. How do you serve a subpoena? You know, how do you do a search warrant in these far-flung plants or companies? And that was really that is what the heparin crisis to me illustrates.
Well, this raises questions about globalization generally, because I think, as you point out in the book, the heparin situation was not long after we were having the revelations about lead paint on toys and other products coming from China. And overall, it's easy for someone sitting in a chair in a radio studio in Oregon to get the idea that the idea of globalization on a corporate level got a chance to spread long before the regulators had a chance to say, should we talk about this?
That's right. It looks to me like there was never really a thought-out system for how to properly regulate these overseas plants. It was more like a mad dash to keep up. And, you know, a lot of this expansion of an overseas drug supply was driven by a political desire for low-cost, you know, a real consumer need, mm-hmm. and a kind of political win, you know, for people who supported this generic drug boom. But, you know, there's a lot of questions there. Why haven't we found a way to meaningfully regulate brand-name drug prices? You know, maybe if we had had a better system for price regulation, we wouldn't be so dependent on this low-cost supply from overseas.
Ah, so the name brand drugs, because they get to be so expensive, and you get the likes of the pharma bro, Martin Shkreli, just going, oh, I'm going to raise it by this much. I mean, he certainly gave a black eye to the whole business, but you know, it gave the idea that the drug companies can basically set the prices where they want. If the insurance companies don't like it, go find a generic. I dare you.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, insurance companies are driving consumers toward generic drugs, low-cost medicine, any way they can, right? And in many cases, there is no brand name alternative anymore. The brand name companies have dropped out. So we really are, you know, consumers are really stuck and dependent on these drugs. And then the question is, well, how are these drugs being made? And how are they being regulated?
Well, and then, yeah, the regulated part is a big one because you mentioned Peter Baker, who was doing his visit to plants in India. He's now visiting plants in China. How many people like him does the FDA have stationed in China?
At one point, he was the only drug inspector based in China to inspect over 400 plants. Now, the FDA has a cadre of inspectors that they bring over from the U.S., you know, but the idea originally that they would have foreign offices and, you know, people that they could deploy who are inside of the country, that just hasn't panned out. So what we have is this really threadbare system run on an honor system, you know, with minimal oversight in environments where there is a lot of fraud. So what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. Let's take a call here from Bill in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Catherine Eben, the author of Bottle of Lies. Bill, go ahead.
Yes, I came up with an idea 20 years ago before Walmart, or 30 years ago before Walmart really ruined the country, making all of the manufacturing overseas. And I think we could make some, use it part of it to help stop our drug problem of bad products. And that is... if the company goes overseas, they would have to pay a tax and take somewhat of the cost of living goods to that country. And the tax would pay for the policing. I wonder if we could do that with embargo and drugs coming into our country that are not that far. They'd have to pay a tax, and then that would be for a good policing source. So the FDA could go over there and really check them out because they have that funding.
Okay, we lost a little bit of that to cell phone fade, but I got the general gist. Is that you want to tax on companies that do business overseas to come up to something like our standard of living?
You know, the one of the big questions that the coronavirus has exposed is how can we bring manufacturing back home? You know, how can we incentivize companies to manufacture here? And how can we essentially penalize companies that take their manufacturing abroad? And, you know, as one person described it to me recently, you need a kind of World War II style, all of government effort to change this. This is not something that you can do quickly and easily. You know, you need a massive program to drive manufacturing back home. And I just wonder whether we will, you know, emerge from this crisis with a resolution to make our own medicine.
You wonder about that. You also, but it goes a little further for me because watching the way American supply chains tend to work, we love the just-in-time parts supply thing where you reduce warehouses and terminal dwell time. But it seems like when you get a situation like this where you need a bunch of stuff at once, it's not capable of keeping up.
Right, which is why you have to essentially rethink the whole system. So there isn't really a simple fix, but there is one fix that I have discussed. Right now, if you go into a Whole Foods and you can find out where your apple came from and you can find out where your breakfast cereal was manufactured, right? But there is no country of origin labeling for drug ingredients or finished doses. Now, I think one way to drive manufacturing back home is if consumers had that, if you mandated that, and they began to realize where their drugs are being made, it would really incentivize manufacturers as a brand distinction to make it in the USA. I think many people would prefer to take that medicine. So I think that that would be something very important to mandate. You'd have to do it through legislation.
Catherine, I'm down to my last minute with you, but I have to ask. I have to believe you get a prescription filled now and then. Do you get generics like the rest of us?
I do, because it's unavoidable, but there are also companies whose drugs I just won't take. So because I have all this knowledge in my head, I tend to make specific requests of which manufacturers I want. Now, how can the ordinary person do that? On my website, KatherineEban.com, I have a guide to investigating your own drugs. And, you know, it's not perfect, but I do have some tools there for consumers to follow if they want to try to figure out, you know, where their drugs are coming from and how to get the best ones.
All right, KatherineEban.com. Catherine Eban, of course, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange and the author of Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. A lot of work went into this book. It's very thorough. Catherine, thank you so much for the work and for joining us on the Exchange.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
All right, take care. We're ending the show alternately early and late. We're skipping As It Was today because since we can't get Shirley into the studio because of social distancing, we've been running reruns. And, of course, this one's make a reference to the Pear Blossom Parade, which isn't happening this year in Medford. So let me just round out the rest of the hour by talking about our fund drive. We actually do have a fund drive going on right now, but it's not the full bells and whistles, constantly interrupting program with happy talk from partners in the studio kind of fund drive. But we do have a fund drive going. We are trying to raise whatever people can deliver this time. So we're up to almost $30,000 with just a few people to thank here. And it's Carol and Mary Pfeiffer in Reading, Megan Kapp and Anna Stevens in Medford, and Manuel D'Aquino in Ashland. Thank you all for supporting Jefferson Public Radio. That's today's Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.